It's my absolute pleasure to welcome Priyank and Mukesh to Network Capital. Today, we're going to talk about their partnership and their book. And for some of you who know me, of course, I've studied at INSEAD at Oxford, but Ashoka is has a very special place in my heart. And after Ashish Dhawan, one of the co-founders, Pramath Raj Sinha, and a wide range of our mentors, I'm delighted to have Priyank on Network Capital. And Mukesh, who's the author of the book, along with Priyank, has an illustrious career. And we're going to talk about, of course, their achievements. But let's get started with how do you both know each other? And what does this jugalbandi truly entail of writing a book at a time like this?
Go ahead,
Okay.
Priyank. So that's the jugalbandi utkarsh. I just picked up a job at IIM Ahmedabad. We had relocated from the US and I was working there and our daughter was studying at Ashoka. So that's how I had an interest in somehow getting to know Ashoka a little better. And then Priyank landed up at IIM Ahmedabad. He's an alum and then he knows Sanjeev well. And then I overheard conversations about possibly getting involved in teaching a course. So then I went there a couple of times. I met the students. I didn't think I could add any value. I was wondering why they would listen to an old fart like me. But after talking to them and then engaging with them, despite my daughter advising everybody that don't take my dad's class, Priyank encouraged me to offer a close. And I think it was a third or fourth course on campus. And then Priyank supported us in, teaching undergrads is very different from teaching at an MBA institute. So it required a little bit of a change in mindset.
I can imagine. And
So
Priyank.
what's going on? Mukesh and I have been working now for 8 years. I have to say that, it's not just one course or two courses that he offers at Ashoka. He's actually helped build the entire offering at the Center for Entrepreneurship and has been very pivotal in what we've been able to offer at Ashoka. So we've been working together. We've been teaching liberal arts students. And of course, both of us come from an MBA background. So we've been teaching across the board. So that's how we've got the entire spectrum of understanding how liberal arts students think differently from how MBA students think, and of course, the engineering students and other streams. And that's been the context of how we came together. We've also had Utkarsh, a number of our students who actually interact with us at various fora and talk about what's worked for them. And that's been a lot of what's led to Leapfrog.
Fantastic book. Why did you write it though?
See, from
So
my perspective, sorry. Go ahead.
part of it was what I was talking about, which is a lot of the students actually come and talk to us, share with us what's worked for them. Alumni, recruiters share what makes a good student become a good professional. And that's a very important transition, right? And then if you look at longitudinal study, which is all based on alumni coming and sharing stories with us, there are some who really outperform others, right? And that's what we wanted to capture. We wanted to really put down what works for people who've done well, our students, people we've worked with, we've interacted with over the years. And Leapfrog is an attempt to bring that out for the larger audience because Mukesh teaches at IIM Ahmedabad and Ashoka, and I teach at Ashoka. And both these classrooms are fairly selective. It's if you really wanted that, these conversations to go to a larger audience. So that was a big part of why we decided to write. But Mukesh has one more reason, which I'll let him share.
So, at the IIM, especially in the top IIMs, the pressure is on publishing all the time. So we call it a publish or perish culture. And the publishing is just not in any journal. It has to be an A-grade journal. But the problem with that approach is that the number of people who potentially can read what you write is very small. I mean, we joke, it's probably a dozen people, of which half of them are your own PhD students. And secondly, the nature of academic writing is such
that it's not easy to peruse. I mean, I keep joking that when my wife can't sleep, she picks up all my research papers and 5 minutes later she's fast asleep. So the feeling always has been, how do you reach a wider audience? And that's how the idea of a book came up, that why don't we go and pick up stuff that is there in the social sciences that we are so familiar with, that stays in journals. Why not bring it to a larger audience and through a book?
In that regard, also, because both of you are trained academics, writing a book which makes a lot of sense for young people is not such an easy job. So how did you think of the structure? How did you come up with the overarching theme of the book?
Yeah. So, Utkarsh, there are a number of ideas that sort of we played with, toyed with. But ultimately, the core of all of this is to give nuggets which are chewable, which are implementable. And there is an action after every bit of reading, right? Because there are lots of books on self-help. There are lots of books that help you build your career, help you do well in your job, in your life, as an entrepreneur, and so on. So our idea was to simplify it and make it purely story-based. Each story is actually backed by research. So it's not just sharing with you anecdotes, but those anecdotes are evidence-based. So that is the principle that we followed. And we thought that six is a good number for all the good reasons. And the good part is that each practice that we talk about, the six practices to thrive that we talk about, are supported by pillars. So there are three pillars that support every practice. So that's how we looked at the structure of the book. Mukesh?
Dancing with disciplines, Mukesh, if that's okay with you. Both of you know Ashoka, liberal arts very well. And as the person hosting you, I have studied that, enjoyed and benefited a ton as an entrepreneur from the liberal arts training. Talk to us about your perspective. What does that chapter, because that's my favorite chapter in the book. So I thought we'll start there and then work backwards.
You're
What's
talking
the
about the liberal arts
insight there?
chapter, right? The chapter on disciplines, unboxing disciplines. Yeah. So, you know, I have been teaching in the US at liberal arts colleges too. And the variety of students you have in the US is many fold what we have in India. You have a music major sitting in your class, you have an English major, you have a religion major. And we do a lot of teaching through case studies. I mean, that's how we are trained to teach. So you have a case study which you start analyzing. And the interesting part is that when students come to class, they have highlighted some post parts of the case study. They have written in the margins, they put their comments in. And you pick up a case study that is being looked at by a student from, let's say, an engineering student. We had an engineering college on campus in the US. And you look at the same case study being analyzed with somebody from the liberal arts, from sociology or psychology. And they have completely different perspectives. So to me, that is the challenge and the fun, that to bring all these perspectives together and then take a big picture view of the case. So that's how I got intrigued into doing this.
And you, Priyank?
Yeah. So I think Ashoka is where the idea of liberal arts got popularized with many, many people. And I have to admit that, you know, I hadn't taken liberal arts as seriously as I do now after being part of the Ashoka ecosystem, right? And it's truly about having diverse ideas come together, right? Diversity works. It's worked wherever there has been innovation, it's been an outcome of diversity. And so I think the liberal arts ethos is something that we need to imbibe in everything that we do. Every organization needs to have that in different ways, in different forms. And that's really what we've talked about in that chapter about disciplines colliding with each other. Every element of new thinking is a collision of diverse ideas. There is a theory which is that there is nothing new in this world, everything is a rearrangement of what exists. And the rearrangement happens when different disciplines, different ideas, the diverse mindsets actually are put together. So that's the power of liberal arts education, liberal arts thinking. And I guess that's what we've talked about in the book as well.
You know, I'll just quote a small example here. In the chapter Dance with Disciplines, we're talking about a guy called a person who's working for Rally Health, Tom. And Tom is asked that with artificial intelligence and computer skills, do you really need the liberal arts majors? What value do they add? And I'm using a quote that we've used in the book when he says, what can't be replaced in any organization imaginable in the future are the liberal arts skills, such as creativity, empathy, listening, and vision. These skills, not digital or technological ones, will hold the keys to a company's future success. I think there's a realization today that you need the liberal arts majors sitting in the same room as the engineers and the doctors and the lawyers and the computer scientists to get a comprehensive big picture.
100%. And we talk about contradisciplinary learning, learning across disciplines. And as an entrepreneur, investor, you need to be able to bring that to fore, which is why so many multi-billion dollar founders like Reid Hoffman studied philosophy and symbolic systems. And we see that, of course, among Ashoka founders as well. But do you feel that in the era of AI and automation, the importance of liberal arts is being questioned by some people?
Actually, Utkarsh, just to the contrary, you know, one of the challenges we have as educators, one of the challenges that we have as parents is that we are preparing our children, our students for a career where they need, where the future, we don't know what holds for them, right? For jobs that don't yet exist. So what do we teach them? How do you prepare somebody where we don't know what kind of disruption will happen in the next 2-3 years? So no longer we're talking about 10 years. We're no longer in decades, right? For example, ChatGPT. It's a disruption that happened over the last 1.5 to 2 years, maybe less, right? So the only thing that's really left to teach is the way you think, the element of critical thinking, which is the core of liberal arts. And that is, if we can, you know, in very simple terms, people ask us, what do you teach at the university? And we often give this answer. We say, we teach them how to read and write, right? Which is, again, a counterintuitive answer, right? Because at a university, you're expected to teach so much more. But what are we teaching them? We're teaching them to think critically. And you can teach critical thinking through any subject. So as long as you're preparing them to be great thinkers through the process of liberal arts, they'll be able to embrace the future as it unfolds with whatever disruptions or innovations that come their way.
You know, Fareed Zakaria has that famous quote that with the liberal arts, we don't teach you how to make a living. We teach you how to make a life. And I think we've used that in the book also.
So what advice do you both give to your children about artificial intelligence and liberal arts?
Mukesh?
In my case, my children give me advice. So I don't think I'm going to answer that question because my children have grown up. But Priyank can possibly take a stab at that.
So Utkarsh, I think it's something that is for here to stay. You've got to embrace it. You've got to integrate with whatever you do. You have to use it for the better. You don't have to, but you shouldn't be dependent on it. You shouldn't stop thinking because the machine is thinking for you, right? At the end of the day, there is, it's a decision support technology. It's helping you to make better decisions. It shouldn't be making decisions for you. And that's the core of the advice we share with students, with, of course, our children and so on. Of course, you need to be great at it, because people who are not embracing the technology, who are not experts at the technology, are going to get disrupted themselves. So it's important to not shy away from it, but use it to your advantage judiciously.
Yeah, just building off of what Mukesh and Priyank have said, I once heard a lecture where Ram Guha at Ashoka was talking about disciplinary chauvinism. I don't know how that happened, but in academia, disciplinary chauvinism has become like a mainstream strand where you need to be a specialist before getting into a big picture thinking. And I think there are lots of negative byproducts that emerge from it. And I think dancing with discipline sort of overcomes that to some extent. Is it okay if we just stick on liberal arts for a little longer?
Sure.
How do you both think about generalists and specialists? This debate comes up a lot. Should people specialize too soon? How do you balance that? What's the leapfrogging technique there?
So I'll give you an example of how important it is to be a generalist today while specializing in a field. Now, we talk of a T-shaped profile where you are deep in one field and you are a so-called expert in that, but you have knowledge of other fields. Today, when you publish in top journals and our academy meetings often have a subtitle on it, and they ask you when you are publishing a paper, A, they want people from other disciplines involved in that paper. And they ask a simple question, so what? So you have to write an entire paragraph or two explaining what does this research actually mean in practice. And we find that when you get people from other disciplines involved in your writing process, you're able to publish a much better paper. So I don't agree that this discussion about generalists and specialists is more oriented towards specialists. You could say, loosely, we want specialists who can also engage with other disciplines.
Very well said.
Utkarsh, I think you've used this word as well, right? Deep generalists.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of merit there. And I'll try and explain it again slightly differently, which is in today's time, everybody has multiple interests, multiple hobbies, vocations, multiple careers that they want to be associated with. So how do you build a T-shaped profile? What does deep generalist mean here? Well, you can flirt with as many ideas, hobbies, or things that you want to moonlight on. But the deep means that you need to build the expertise in at least one. You need to be known for that one. You need to create an identity around that one. And then you have all the others that you still do and enjoy and play with and flirt with as and when you can, and you sort of build all of that together through the process of being a generalist there. So there is a lot of merit in being a deep generalist. And I think we will see more and more people trying to embrace this model.
You know, there's a company called IDEO, IDEO for short, that you're probably familiar with. And they have a concept of strong ideas loosely held, which I find very, very poetic. You have strong ideas, but you're willing to hold them loosely and trade them with the strong ideas of other people and then come out with better solutions to so-called wicked problems, which have no answers really.
You know, Mukesh, there's this person called Paul Saffo who came up also with this concept of strong opinions weakly held. This is helpful in negotiating political conflict. So I think this whole construct from IDEO to political dialectic is an interesting narrative. You both talk about the importance of experimentation and grit. What does that practically mean for young professionals? How should people think about it?
So let me start with talking about grit. And you know, grit is the first chapter, Utkarsh. Grit essentially means your perseverance and passion sustained over a period of time. And you know, we've been talking about multiple interests and multiple careers, etc. All of that precedes one thing. You need to be able to sustain that interest. And you need to be able to sustain your passion along with it and not get bored, not get distracted, and practice that craft over and over and over again. And so it's very important, Utkarsh, that you can learn various techniques, tricks, practices, everything, but there's no shortcut to hard work. There's no shortcut to putting in the hours. And we've talked about how many hours you need to put in, what makes you a maestro, how you sort of perfect your craft, and so on and so forth. But ultimately, some of the best sports professionals in the world have also acknowledged the fact that they get bored in the process of becoming great at whatever they do. And the key to that is embracing boredom, being able to acknowledge that learning a craft to becoming perfect at it will require a certain amount of dealing with boredom. This is very relevant at today's time, more so because the attention span is just falling. The way engagement models are being developed, we're talking about 3 seconds, 5 seconds, or even less. So that's where we need to acknowledge this and go back to the fundamentals and say, what is it that we're going to do to build in that grit and deal with the boredom and sustain our interest in an area, in a craft over a period of time? Mukesh, anything?
Ingrid, we talk of this phenomena of deliberate practice. Now, Malcolm Gladwell popularized this idea in one of his books, where you felt that if you did the same thing again and again and again, you'll become better at it. And the answer is not really. But if you start improving yourself by just 1% every time you do an act, an activity, then over a period of 365 days, you'll be 37 times as good as you were when you started that. That is the power of compounding, the power of what we call deliberate practice, where you start improving and you work on what you are not doing correctly. We all tend to work and repeat what we do well, thinking we want to become an expert in it. But the way to do it in grit is to persevere, but do it intelligently.
Yes, iterative practice and compounding. Very helpful advice.
Utkarsh, I want to add one quick point here, and I think this will be very relevant to your Network Capital members, which is in along with grit, especially with deliberate practice, we bring about the importance of mentorship and a coach. And it's very important that you find a mentor. It's very important that you take advice and input, because a lot of people believe that everything is self-help today. Everything is online and I'll do it myself. Right? There is a value to a human mentor and a coach. And it's very important that you look for the right person and engage with the right person and develop that mentorship model. Because only then that you'll be able to get ideas or thoughts beyond what you think are right. So that's an important part of how you build deliberate practice.
Very important
And
from
you guys have really helped people find mentors and create this whole model of mentorship at Network Capital. So kudos for that.
thank you. It's really mentorship has played a crucial role in my life. And I thought that just because I've gone to good education institutes and worked at good places, maybe my network and my mentorship tribe is owing to that. So what would it take to truly democratize mentorship? That was the founding thesis of Network Capital. And once I remember I came and spoke in your class, Priyank, when we were discussing the design principles of how might one think about it. And I talked a bit about behavioral economics and the nudge principle, which Mukesh and you also talk about. Do you want to discuss that and give some examples of how young professionals can apply the nudge principle to, advance their careers?
Mukesh, would you like to?
Yeah, go ahead. You go ahead.
Okay, great. So, nudge is the behavioral economics theory, which was proposed by Richard Thaler. Essentially, what we are suggesting here is, are there tricks that can work for you? Are there tricks that will really make you behave differently? Right? There are small examples that we've talked about, which are how the external world constantly is playing games in the way you choose things online. this whole idea of making decisions based on what is shown to you is really nudging you to make a purchase decision. So can you use the same theory that will work on you? So one example which we've talked about is for somebody trying to lose weight, can you use a smaller spoon to eat so that you eat slowly and the quantity of food that you actually consume over a period of time is much less than what you would do with a bigger spoon, right? That's an element of nudging yourself, right? One of our students suggested this. He said, "I never get to play the guitar because I'm always studying, busy with my preparation and things like that." And then I asked him, "Where have you put your guitar?" "Oh, it's in the loft upstairs." He got the guitar down, placed it next to his table, and left it there. He said, "For 2 days, I didn't do anything. I didn't touch the guitar. But from third day onwards, when I was taking a break, instead of hitting my phone and Instagram, I picked up the guitar and started strumming it." And the student realized over a period of time that he had actually played the guitar much more than what he would do when he said, "Oh, this is my guitar hour." Right? So it's a small nudge. It's just nudging you by placement, right? Many, many stores, supermarkets would have food which get picked up because it's at the eye level. So if you want people to eat healthy in an office, actually Google did this, they placed all the healthy food at eye level to nudge people to pick up the healthier foods. So there are various tricks that will work on you, and you need to figure out where you need help and what will work for you. And of course, there are a whole bunch of examples in the book which you can sort of get inspired with.
Yeah, I've tried a few of these tricks on myself. For example, I constantly floss my teeth, and now I floss my teeth immediately after eating a meal, so that I don't eat or nibble away till the next meal. And I heard about this from a colleague, and I found it really works well. The other thing I enjoy is making checklists, and then scratching off things as the checklist. As you do things, and then you feel really good about it. In fact, I have to catch myself from cheating to write something down I've already done, just to be able to scratch it out.
That's funny. Yeah.
So these are small things that small ways you can nudge yourself. And Priyanka is giving lovely stories from our own students on how they nudge themselves.
Okay, sure. One of the people that we hosted on Network Capital, he built a company called Read Something Great. Started off as a passion project, still is. And their nudge is that instead of quickly scrolling social media or tweeting about some political outrage, just go read something great. So what they do is they curate five interesting articles that's built in a very beautiful UI, where the nudge is go read instead of go check social media. And through your book, you emphasize that people can be applying it to whatever framework they like, and see how they deem fit.
That's wonderful, Utkarsh. You know, one of the things about nudging is about celebrating a small win. You know, it's not about saying I've done this really big task. And it's like Mukesh was saying, you know, every small thing scratching off, feel good about everything that every small reading that you do, you feel good about. So celebrate every small bit. And I think that's a very important part of, you know, the small bits coming together for, you know, a habit that you've been trying to work on, changing that habit. So yeah, it really works. And more than that, I think it's also how you socialize, because a lot of the nudging actually happens with the social groups around you. So, you know, there are lots of statistics on there are chances that you'll quit smoking by more than 50% if your spouse or partner stops smoking, right? So it starts from there, and then depending on the percentage keeps going down depending on how much time you're spending with your best friend and your neighbors and as far as you can keep going. But the idea really, all of these statistics mean only one thing, that social circles that we hang out with have a huge impact on the way we behave. And very often, behavioral change that we want to bring about will have to happen with the social group that we hang out with.
Yeah. Thank you for that. For me, hosting the Network Capital podcast is also a nudge. I've always read more, but this way I get to speak with some of the best authors and CEOs and practitioners. So it nudges me to continue reading. It's a little forcing function, something that you create for yourself, but it's an important part of, like, our collective learning journey. One thing that strikes me about, professors at top-notch universities is that generally they would encounter successful people, illustrious students doing amazing things, investors, founders with, beautiful CVs. Do you think it costs them intellectual humility at some time? How do people, or how should people remain intellectually humble throughout their journey, not just in the beginning, but through the end? What does this mean to you?
I'll let Mukesh start with this one. It's his favorite chapter.
I'll give the example of IIM Ahmedabad. Now, when you get into IIM Ahmedabad, you assume that you are the, the upper crust, till you find that everybody comes from a similar background. And I remember experiencing that myself when I joined the IIT decades ago, that you were, the cat's whiskers, till you go there and find that everybody has stopped. So I think that's the first signal to you that you are not as smart as you think you are. And I think intellectual humility is one of the most important aspects if you want to grow, to know what you don't know and accept that the initial confidence that you have may not be justified. We use this curve that we, a graph that we explain that when you first encounter a field, you think you know all about it. Then as you start digging into it, you realize how little you know till you reach the bottom and you feel, I know nothing about the field. But you continue and persevere to study it, to analyze it, to engage with it. And your confidence level starts growing. So I think it's the ability to know what you don't know. And we've used countless examples in the book. I mean, hilarious examples of that robber who applies, lime on his face, thinking that, lime will make him invisible. Because the old story goes that if you, write with ink or write with lime on paper, it's invisible. And he tests himself and he says, no, I'm invisible. And then he goes and robs a bank. And he's captured by the cameras. So when the cops land up at his place, he says, but I applied the lime. I painted myself. And that gets a professor to wonder, can we be so stupid that we don't know how stupid we are? And that's called the Dunning effect. So we've used these examples and stories to push home a point that you need to be intellectually humble and learn from others.
You know, Utkarsh, there is a famous quote, and you talked about illustrious people and that one would interact with who are well accomplished. The quote goes like this: "The more you know, the more you know how less you know." And this is something which we've seen with some of the most senior people we've interacted with. So intellectual humility is the core of being a continuous learner. Being a continuous learner is one of the competencies that you will have to imbibe, because the world is changing so fast that if you're not continuously learning, you will get disrupted. But to be a continuous learner, you need to be intellectually humble. And so it's something which definitely is a very critical practice for everybody to imbibe.
Yeah, the Dunning-Kruger effect that Mukesh talked about, the examples that you've given, is very important to keep in mind no matter what your career trajectory looks like. And it brings me to the point about the curation of knowledge, like how do you filter signal from noise? So I'd love to hear from you about, among your students, the people that you interact with in your own lives, how do you sort of curate that signal noise filter? And how do you process information? How do you create a good knowledge diet for yourself?
This was Priyank's favorite chapter. He wanted curation to be there. And go ahead.
You're spilling the beans, Mukesh.
That's what this podcast is for.
You know, Utkarsh, we are inundated with so much of data, so much of information, so much of knowledge. Anybody who can distill that
is actually creating. So curation is creation. If you can curate well, you're actually creating. Spotify is a classic example. Netflix is a classic example. They are curating for you. They're curating as for you as an individual based on what you will want to see from the ginormous data sets that they're sitting on. And they are both examples of how startups have just curated well and become globally successful startups, right? I'll give you a very interesting example. Of course, it's talked about in the book. It's about an experiment which was done in Menlo Park. It's about how people choose, right? So there was a researcher who put out six flavors of jam on one table outside a supermarket and 36 flavors of jam on the other door of the supermarket. And as people walked in, they were, you know, asked to taste different flavors, and based on their reactions, they could go in and get a coupon to buy or at a discount inside. Can you guess which table bought more? The interesting answer is that only 3% of the people who went to the table with 36 flavors of jam actually made a purchase. But 30% of the people who went to the table, which had only six flavors of jam, made a purchase. They were given a curated choice. They were given the best six flavors, probably. And they believed that they're making the right decision. People make decisions based on how choices are presented to them. So curation is a very, very important skill in this era where we are inundated with everything around us. And it's going to be a key differentiator for people, professionals, entrepreneurs who leapfrog.
Very important point.
You know, Michael Pollan, the food writer, has distilled his advice about eating healthy in seven words. You're probably aware of it. You're smiling and you know about it.
It's seven words.
He says, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And these are possibly the seven best words of advice that you can have about a healthy diet. So curation is what we should all be doing all the time. It took me some time to buy into the idea when Priyank proposed it. But the more you dig into it, the more you realize, especially today, when you are inundated with choice, what do you do?
I mean, I have to ask, do you follow Pollan's advice?
You're asking me personally? 100%. I mean, I've become a vegetarian 7, 8, 10 years ago. And now this other Japanese idea of eating till you are 80% full, which again we've used in the book, because it takes that long for the food to send a signal to the brain that, or the stomach to send a signal to the brain that you are full. So these are small ways of nudging, of curating, which is what the book is about.
I think so. Both the examples are very, very important to keep in mind, because it has implications not just in what you eat, but generally how you think about, like, it's a principle, which is why I think both of you put it in the book. Another one that really jumped out at me was thinking like an entrepreneur and asking precisely what you want. I'd love for you to, you know, talk us through what that means at a practical level, and how can young people train themselves to follow that practice.
So, Utkarsh, if you allow me, I'm going to read out a paragraph from the book.
Please.
It's one of our favorite stories, and maybe we can then talk about, how it's relevant to members of Network Capital. In 2019, Satvik Hegde was standing in line to welcome Prime Minister Narendra Modi during his visit to Houston, Texas. Over 50,000 people had gathered to see and hear the Indian Prime Minister and then US President Donald Trump. As the two leaders walked past the children, Satvik stepped forward and asked for a selfie. President Trump agreed. Prime Minister Modi, who'd walked a few steps ahead, turned back to join the huddle. Extending his hand, Sattvic clicked the most powerful selfie in the world. The expression on the face of the girl next to Sattvic told a bigger story. Her eyes widened as her hands covered her mouth. How could Sattvic be so audacious? Later in a television interview, the 13-year-old was nonchalant. He said, "It doesn't really hurt to ask for something you want. If you don't ask, the answer is always no." And Utkarsh, it is this spirit of entrepreneurial courage and entrepreneurial mindset, of having the audacity to ask and ask well. And again, coming back to network capital, Utkarsh, you've created an environment where people ask each other and they create this camaraderie of asking without feeling embarrassed about the help that they need. And it's important that we create communities where entrepreneurs can thrive because they need this help. They need the audacity to ask and get that help that they need. But it's a very important element that you've touched upon in entrepreneurial thinking, and I think it's something which everybody should really leverage a platform like Network Capital for their own benefit, and of course contribute to it as well.
And Utkarsh, this is not something new. Steve Jobs has that 2-minute video, which has been downloaded, I think, a few million times, where he was a kid and he wanted to make a frequency counter. So he looks up the telephone book, and Bill Hewlett's name is still there in the telephone book. So this 13-year-old kid gives a call, and Bill Hewlett picks up the phone, and Steve Jobs says that, "Sir, I want parts to build a frequency counter." So Bill Hewlett laughs and says, I mean, he's pretty tickled by this, and says, "Come over, come to my factory." Not only does he get the parts, he gets a job in summer, and that puts him on the way to becoming to where Apple was finally. So the ability to ask is something that entrepreneurs don't even think about. It's their second nature, and they don't feel bad if they get a no. But the rest of the people tend to be a little hesitant in asking for fear of getting a no.
I mean, as an entrepreneur, you just have to get used to the idea of hearing no. Without that, it's very difficult to build something. And I think the way you've laid it out, both in the context of entrepreneurship, but how can people adopt the entrepreneurial practice in their work lives, daily lives, I think is brought about really effectively in the book. I see both of you as academic entrepreneurs. The way you build your respective careers, the way you've looked at academic literature and thought about sharing it with a general audience, and just sharing and being entrepreneurial about your career from the US to India, Middle East, Africa, so on and so forth. So for us, it's wonderful to listen to you. The last aspect of today's discussion, I'd like you all to tell us about PJM, what that is, and more specifically, when people read the book, how should they think about incorporating its principles to shape their work lives?
So, Utkarsh, many of your listeners would have heard of the business model canvas. A
Yes.
business model canvas is a very simple 9-box framework to list down your business idea on a one-pager. The personal journey map is an adaptation of the business model canvas. The difference is that it is working on the startup of you. So if you were a startup, if you have to take your life and your career and whatever you want to achieve as a professional, what is it that you can do to plan that out? Right? So it's a journey, it's mapping your journey. It starts with identifying what's important to you, what resources you have, what are the gaps, what are the opportunities. The fifth box is actually very exciting. It says, what are the sacrifices that you're willing to make? Because you've got all of this mapped out, but you're not willing to make a sacrifice, you're not going to get there. Right? So you list down all the sacrifices and then you talk about how you're going to get there. So you start listing down the first step of whatever you want to achieve. And in the book, we've talked about many of our students have filled the personal journey map. It's worked for them. It's a fairly robust tool. So we've given samples of how it's worked for them, how they've used it, how they filled it up. And of course, there are some, you know, guiding questions for each of these boxes. So there's a lot of material available for anybody who wants to implement the six practices. The purpose of putting the personal journey map out there is that it's, you know, it's easy to give gyan and expect people to do what they want to do with it. But we wanted to give them a toolkit that can actually help them implement some elements of what they pick up from the book.
See, the other thing about the PJM is that it is not a static document. It's not carved in stone. So what you need to do is to fill it up and then go and revisit it at periodic intervals to find where you have grown, where you have not, what else you can do. And I'll go back to what Priyank mentioned at the start, the importance of having a mentor, which is true about deliberate practice, which is the context in which we talked about, but equally true in the case of a PJM. Who are those role models that you intend following, whose help you intend seeking? So the PJM is like the BMC or the lean startup, which entrepreneurs use all the time, but it's the lean startup of you. And it's something that you keep looking at and working at and improving and carrying on. You know, a lot of the courses that we teach at Ashoka, or the course I teach, is creating an entrepreneurial mindset. Now, it may or may not result in a business. That's not the important part of it. It's the ability to recognize opportunities, to evaluate them, to discover them, and then to exploit them if you so desire. But that is, I think, more important than just entrepreneurship as a business.
Really well said. I encourage everyone listening in to give the BJM a shot and send your comments and feedback to Priyank and Mukesh on Twitter or something of that sort. I would like to conclude by saying how important this book is for young professionals and also executives to redesign their career principles. For one of my papers, I was just researching and found that 85% of jobs of 2030 do not exist today. So redesigning your work lives is not just a nice thing to do. If you don't do it, you'll find yourself without a job, or, you know, pretty soon. So take a look at leapfrogging. And just like towards the end, Mukesh, Priyank, is there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't? Or any parting words that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I would say have fun reading the book and implementing it, because there is a lot in the journey that you'll enjoy. So most important part is enjoy the journey. I think that's my last word on this.
And coming back to curation, which my contribution in that chapter was the ability to identify bullshit. Because I think that, as you know, we've used a quote there, that the major part of education is be able to know where the truth lies, identify it, and then use it and implement it. So separate the wheat from the chaff. So I think I would like to, I mean, that's probably something that I learned myself from that chapter.
Wonderful. So just, I won't try and summarize this entire podcast. I encourage you to read the book. But there are multiple key takeaways from disciplinary dancing to thinking about BJM to removing bullshit to thinking from first principles. Congratulations to both of you. I know the book is officially a bestseller. I hope that you got a chance to celebrate it with a glass of champagne or something. And I look forward to celebrating with you both in India sometime.